Okay, I purposefully would like to address something that we spoke about last year or 2 years ago and to come at it at a whole new, with a whole new understanding. I want to begin with a story and speak about two parts of the weekly portion, one more known, one less known. The story that I would like to share is about a man that lived around 2,000 plus years ago, 2,100 years ago. His name was Nachum, and we called him Nachum Ish Gamzu, the man of Gamzu. Gamzu is an expression that for him was much more than just an expression, but it was something that he said when he encountered that which appeared to be not good. And he would say, Gam zu l'toiva. This too is good. I know that someone could interpret the words, this too is for the good, but I purposefully would like to interpret what he said is that this too is good. And the famous story that the Talmud records about a person with this attitude is that there was a time that there was a decree against the Jewish community. It was some sort of religious persecution decree, which was so common. And the only way around it was to get that decree nullified. Whether it was you can't do Bris Milah, or you can't keep Shabbos, or a Jew tax that was beyond the ability for people to pay. And one of the methods that were used were to bribe the officials, people in charge. And there's a risk to that. There's knowing how to do it. And they designated him to be the one to attempt to bribe the representative of Rome in Israel, from whom came that decree. So monies were raised and they put the chest together, a real treasure chest, diamonds and pearls and gold and what have you. And on the way going to bribe the Caesar's representative, he stayed over one night in a hotel. And the hotel owner or the hotel manager somehow intuited that he was coming with an entourage, going to speak to whatever that person's name was, saw this chest, put two and two together, must be a treasure here. That was for him a great opportunity to make a quick dollar. And he managed to take the chest, to empty it from its contents. Not wanting to be caught, he filled it up with dirt. With the dirt from the inn, from the hotel, from the surrounding area. And he put the amount that he felt, you pick up the box, it would feel the same. And with the hope that he won't check, he won't verify, which is exactly what happened. And when he came in front of the Roman official, and with however he worded it, he bribed him. Let me just on the side, just something cute, that I come from Brazil. In Brazil, it wasn't difficult to bribe. In Brazil, the bribing was very direct. My father never had a driving license, never. I mean, he moved there in 1976. I think it was sometimes in the 80s. I was in yeshiva. I had a driving license. I came back home. My father's driving. And he's pulled over by a cop on a country road. So the first thing he does is, Avraham Meir, we're changing seats. I was terrified. The cop is parked behind us. He says, change seats. Evidently, I was more afraid of my father than of the police officer. So first, I'm sitting in the driver's seat. It's like a comedy. He doesn't walk over to me. He walks over to my father, angry. And he tells him, license. My father says, am I driving? To make it worse, he's driving. Avram, he tells me, give him your license. the way he spoke to him. I mean, he bribed him, basically. In Brazil, you bribe with checks. Imagine the chutzpah. You don't have to give cash. I'm not kidding. I don't believe that the world is that pure here. I'm sure here it's a lot more sophisticated. But however he did it, you have to know how to do it. He was ready to receive a bribe. So when he received the bribe and he opened up the chest, imagine, you see a chest, like you're making fun of him, filled with dirt. and he was outraged. Now, when Nachum saw dirt and he realized what happened, so he said, Gamzu litova. And I promise you that those words, without really, really being there, means nothing. Much healthier to say, oh my God, much healthier, more honest. His honesty was Gamzu litova. And the Caesar was going to kill him, was going to take his head off. And the Talmud, that Elijah the prophet appeared in the form of one of his advisors and told him that the Jewish people are known to be a wise people. Why would someone at this moment, when you're making decrees against them, come over here with a box filled of dirt to mock you? Why would they do that? He doesn't appear to be suicidal. So he tells this advisor, okay, so what other option, what other narrative can you give me to make sense of the chutzpah? To which he responds that in the Bible, in the Chumash, we have the story that when Abraham went to wage war against the kings that conquered the other kings that kidnapped his nephew, if you're familiar with that story in Parshas Lech Lecha, Avraham Avinu had a lot of courage, but there's courage and then there's craziness. He went to wage war against an army. So the Torah implies, and it's understood through our commentators, that he simply picked up earth and he threw it at the opposing army, and every granule of earth turned into a spear, turned into a weapon. So there was some sort of, he had a machine gun. He pulled out a machine gun when people were primitive and he won the battle. So he told the king that maybe this earth, maybe the Jews, they know where the earth that turns into spears is to be found, and that's the earth that he bought you because you are at war. Rome was always at war. And in that battle, we're not winning. Maybe this is the way we're going to win. And he took the earth and he took it to the battlefield and he threw it. And indeed, the miracle happened and he won the battle. And in gratitude, not only did he nullify the decree, but he commanded for the chest to be refilled with gold. So the dirt turned out to actually be super gold. And the story goes on, but let's just leave it at that. So when we're younger, we hear the story. The story is about someone whose attitude was that no matter what happened, no matter how horrible it appeared, the attitude was that this is good. And whoever hears the story and shakes their head are people that have it more or less good. Let me tell you, that means you have it good. Because whoever has it bad and hears the story gets very angry at the one who tells the story, even though don't kill the messenger. And that I know, personally. So everything is very good. Even the bad is good when the bad is not really bad. But when the bad is really bad, God forbid, and I think we are all destined to face that as part of our life, these stories can be very irritating and very superficial, or worse. It makes a person feel like this has, there's nothing for me here. Everything is wonderful. Okay, so let's hold that story and we're going to come back to a better understanding of how to turn dirt into gold. That will be the name of the class.
How to turn dirt into gold.
There you go. And who doesn't want to do that? Ooh, we got the secret. Oh, yeah. Let's get rich. Okay. Now, there are two things that happen in this parsha, one of which should bother everyone. And that is that Moses, Moshe Rabbeinu, was not allowed to enter the Holy Land. And it's very difficult to make peace with this type of story. Someone of that level, who did what he did for us, forever, he's like the face of a Jewish leader. What should a leader be like? And when you read the story about he hit the rock and he hit the rock twice, you read the story, no matter how old a person is, there's something missing here. It's not fair. It's really not fair. And I'll tell you more than that, that some people, this can be a personal thing, some people know how to accept what is easier than others, no doubt about that. Moshe Rabbeinu never accepted it. This we know, Moshe Rabbeinu, from the story, until when he passed away, was not accepting of the fact. It was not fear. He was imploring. He was imploring God, God, let me in the land for one day. All the people are going in and I'm staying behind. And people relate to that because I'm sure that every person, when they look at their lives, will say, whether it's objectively true or whether it's certainly subjectively true, that there's this one part of life that everyone else is being allowed into the promised land, and God picked on me, and I am here. If you would only know, you would go crazy, because it just doesn't make sense. And I would even argue that most of us, as much as we can speak about acceptance, we don't accept it. We're coming off the yard site, Hilula, of the Lubavitcher Rebbe, just as an example of our days. How the Rebbe wanted to live to see Mashiach. I was there. And it's very hard to accept the fact that it didn't happen the way he was hoping for it to happen in his lifetime. And I can go on. David HaMelech, and we can go through history. And again, it touches people because it's not just to the great. It's not just in the books. It's personal. That it almost looks like the world is a world in which there is something that's extremely important for us that we're not getting. And we can't make peace with it. It's not fair. And how do we contend with that? What do we do with that? So I'll come back to that. And finally, what we spoke about, I think it was last year, for some reason I this story gets to me, but I want to share another way of approaching it, is a story in which that when the people at some point, this is all of us, when the gifts of life, of what we do have, at some point is taken for granted, we had manna for food. Whatever the manna was, on one hand it was a gift, No hard work. It came to a person with almost no effort, or with no effort, and it was pure nutrition. Many people today, in the way the world is today, they would pay $1 million for it. Had no waste. It was pure food, the healthiest food that can be, and it had an effect not only on the body. It had an effect on the mind. The sages tell us that the Torah was only given to the generation of people that lived off the manna. And by the way, we know that when we eat foods that are not pure, whether it is not kosher, whether it is not healthy, two different things, but I'm correlating them, it does something to us. It does. A person feels it. It affects us. It affects the way we process things. You know, we are becoming more and more aware scientifically of the detrimental effects of alcohol. Just as an example, it really damages the way we understand. We lose our memory. We lose our sharpness. It's bad. And it's funny, at some times in life, many people take it lighter, as they should. And sometimes people get more sensitive and they say, no, well, why would I do that to myself? The manna was like super. The manna was perfect. Yet, it wasn't steak. It wasn't that which we didn't have. And people complained. And this is us. So in other words, when we take for granted that which we have, so if we take that for granted, and there's always that which we don't have, so it's not like there's a balance. God, if you would only be fair to me, you give me something and you take away something, but you're not giving me nothing. I just don't have. And we got negative. We began to complain. So at this point, at this time, the consequence is that snakes, which is a natural phenomenon, snakes live in the desert. We were protected from the snakes miraculously. We just didn't notice that. We didn't acknowledge that. Snakes came and bit the people. All of a sudden, people are being bitten by snakes. A snake is very symbolic in the Torah. Ultimately, the snake represents the Satan himself, the Yetzer Hara, right? The primordial Nachash HaKadmoni, we call him, the primordial snake. We were bitten by snakes. We're dying from snake bites. And God tells Moshe Rabbeinu, craft to yourself
a nachash, make a representation of a snake. Moshe Rabbeinu on his own chose to make it out of copper, because in Hebrew, nachash and the choshes have the same root. He made a copper snake. And God tells him to wrap the snake around the pole, to lift up the pole heavenward. And whoever who is bitten by a snake, if they will look at your snake, they will live. And that's exactly what happened. Happens to be that prior to the story, in other cultures, the snake around the pole, for other cultures, is actually an idolatrous symbol. Something that I just became aware of very recently. I always thought that behind many ambulances you have, many doctors, the symbol of healing is connected to the staff and the snake. For me, what do I know? I hope I know a little bit of the Torah. For me, well, that's, wow, how great is that? It's the Torah. What, just on the side, and recently someone opened up a medical business, and they made a logo, the snake around the stick, and someone told him that it's not appropriate because it's connected to some pagan idolatry. And I said, what are you talking about? It's in this week's parsha. Actually, they were right. I just found out that when the Hatzalah in Crown Heights put that symbol on their Hatzalah ambulance, the Rebbe said that it's better to remove it. Didn't insist on it, because that also represents the story of the parsha. Happens to be that other cultures have that as a symbol of some pagan idolatry. Just end of parentheses. Another parenthesis is that the serpent that Moshe Rabbeinu created that really worked, we had, that was part of our legacy, the Jewish people. Imagine, such an artifact, it's priceless. And King Chizkiyahu, who was a king during the first temple era, at some point destroyed it. Why did he destroy it? Because people, the Mishnah says, how did it work? What, you looked at the snake and you became healed? Does the snake, how can that be? So the Mishnah says, no, that he lifted it up to the heavens. You needed to look up to the heavens. You're looking up to God. When you look up to God, God healed you. As long as people associated healing to God, then we were allowed to have access to that medium, to God's healing. At some point, people gave too much power to the staff itself, instead of giving power to where power is, which is with God. And at that point, it became, even for us, some sort of idolatrous thing. And King Chizkiyahu decided to destroy it. Okay. And the question that we spoke about a while, I'm just repeating one question, a classic question, and that is that when Jews pray, we are actually supposed to look down. Happens to be that many of us pray out of the book, which is the better way to pray. I have yet to see someone putting the book up and looking up. Standing fully upright is not the right posture to stand in. I'm not advocating low self-esteem, but the other side of the same counterfeit coin, which is arrogance, is equally not good. So we don't stand like with the nose in the air. That's a Yiddish expression. Stand straight. Don't stand hunchback, but you don't have to put your nose up there. Stand humble. And when we daven, we're supposed to stand down because we're standing in front of God. So the question is that why did he have to lift it up? Since when a Jew has to put their heart heavenward, do they physically look up? What's the meaning of that? Our heart is to God, but we look down. Another point to make, that God is not only in the heavens. That's a very distorted way of understanding God. God is equally in the heavens and equally in the earth. Actually, we can argue from our perspective, God is to be found more on the earth than in the heavens. And the proof is that God sent us to earth to find Him. And the big mistake that many people make by thinking that God lives in the spiritual exclusively. That's a horrible mistake. That's missing the whole Yiddishkeit. The way Chassidus tells us that God, for us, is to be found in the world. Dafka. God is here. Our goal is to bring heaven down to earth, not to always look up to the heavens. Yeah, if someone passes away, you want to offer very superficial words of consolement. You tell them, well, now you're in a better place. Yeah, but no, this is where it's at. We're lucky to be alive. We want to be here. We want to live, not to be far away from God. We want to live because we want to find God here, with us making here more godly. There's our part to that. There's our work is here. So what's the meaning of looking up? When we say the Shema, and when we are speaking about the type of love that we aspire to have to God, we speak about three types of loves, right? V'yahavta eis Hashem Elokecha. It's a commandment. Not that you can command a feeling. You cannot force a feeling. But it's almost like a promise that at some point we will evolve because of some effort that we make, because of some gift that God will give us, is that we're going to have a real relationship with God that won't be only in the mind. It's going to be an emotional relationship with God, and that will be, we're going to love God. And what do we say? B'chol levavecha, right? We know these words of b'chol nafshecha u'b'chol mo'edecha. I would like to challenge the people that are listening, and don't be ashamed if you don't know the right answer. Explain to me what these three words mean. Even for people who understand Hebrew, that we should love God, we would love to love God. That's where most people are at. Maybe at points, at some moments, we have a real genuine feeling of love to God with all of our hearts. Not b'chol libecha, b'chol levavecha. We love God with all of your hearts. So the sages tell us we have two hearts. We have two hearts. We have, let's say, we have a godly heart. We have a spiritual heart, and we have a very earthly heart. And they both experience loves in very different ways. And our goal is not only to love God with the godly soul, right? We want to love God also with our human soul, with our animal soul. Okay, that I get. So we love God with all of your heart, all of your heart. Okay? Love you with all my... The symbol of love is a heart. Okay, let's go. Let's say we get to what that means. What's the next statement? And then we are saying that we would love to love God with all of our soul. What would that mean? What does it mean to love God with all of your soul, which is beyond with all of your hearts?
Subconscious?
Yeah, I'm saying it, the animal soul and the...
You know, we're not repeating the same thing again.
Beyond the human?
So the pshat, which means the literal is that there are times... There are times that we are meant to love God on such a level that if what we are confronting is a choice between God and something else, and if we were to choose God, we will lose our life, our soul, we will die. There are times, there are certain rare circumstances in which we should give up our very lives. Just to know what the three legally, what the Jewish legally are. Not to commit murder. That means, God forbid, if a person is put in a position where he or she is told, either you kill or you'll be killed. Then, by Jewish law, we're not judging anyone who was unable to do the right thing. It's almost impossible. One is going to lose their lives. In other words, you have to love God even with our very life, giving up our life. The other one is not to serve an idol. In modern terms, which is what happened for the past 2,000 years, is the cross or the sword, right? The Inquisition, which was just closed a couple of years ago. Legally, the Inquisition in our lifetime. I think it was in the 70s or in the 60s that they shut it down. They just didn't act out on it. But the Inquisition, this goes on from the beginning. Bow down to the cross or get killed. All of our grandparents, some of them here, got killed because they didn't bow down to the cross. Literally. They gave up their lives not to convert out. Even when the converting out wasn't something that they believed in, like the Muranos, like the Anusim, the ones that chose to stay in Spain, and then in Portugal, and then in Brazil, and the Inquisition went everywhere, literally, they were saying that we don't mean it. We're just saving our very lives. We don't want to get killed. Literally, they were tortured and murdered. Yet, many people gave up their lives. And I can even say psychologically, it wasn't out of duty. It was out of love. There's some emotional attachment that a Jew has with God. We all have it. It's just buried. That at that point, we can't convert out. It's like betraying God. On that level, we can't do it. Even though it means we're going to die. And the third is adultery. That adultery is such a grave betrayal. And again, this you see, love is connected. That if their love is correct, a person will come to the point and they'll say, even if I will die, I'm not going to betray. That's b'chol nafshecha. These are the three sins for which a person has to give up their lives. There are many nuances to each one legally, halachic legally, but this is the idea. Now, what's u'b'chol me'oidecha? Like, what else, God, what else do you want me to give you? If I'm giving you both of my hearts, and I'm giving you my very life, so what's left to go beyond that? Here is where I would argue most people, even people that say the Shema often, will stop. So, go for it. What does u'b'chol me'odecha mean?
Your money.
Okay, so Rashi writes, very good, with all of your money. And as the Talmud says, that for some people, their money is more dear than their lives. The proof is that they give up their lives for money. Many people risk their lives for money, which means that whether they acknowledge what they're saying with their choice, whether they don't acknowledge it yet, they actually find money more endearing than their own life. So we're telling God that we would love, God is saying, what I would like is for you to love me with all of your hearts and with all of your life and even with all of your money. But that's not true by many people. By many people, it's not emes that money is more than their life. Most people, if they have to choose money or life, they won't give up the money that quick, but if they face it's either or, I think they'll give away their wallet. I would hope I would do that. I'm saying, like, oh my God. We have misunderstandings about ourselves. Some people would not do that because their attachment to things is much deeper than they would like to acknowledge. They're just so ashamed of that part of themselves is that they make believe it doesn't exist. But let's say there are people that are actually more attached to their life than to their money. Okay, so what does b'chol me'odecha mean? Because we're going on a progression from relatively easier to even harder. So if all of your heart, that's a big thing, all of your heart, all of your hearts, okay, with all of your life, if need be, I'll give up my very life, okay? What's beyond that? If money is not beyond that, then what else could b'chol me'odecha be? And the Medrash says something. Where do we find the word ma'od in the Torah the first time? Ma'od means a lot. Ma'od, right?
Creation.
Where do you find it in creation, the word ma'od? Toiv. Toiv, not ma'od. When did God say ma'od? No, it's God created and he saw, ooh, and it's good.
Adam, right? When he created Adam.
It says at the end of the sixth day, because on day number one, and God saw that it's good. He saw the light that it's good. On Monday, he didn't see anything that's good. One of those days. On Tuesday, God said twice, he compensated. That's all of us. Nothing is good. It's great. It's great, good, right? We get it from God. And then Wednesday, okay, we're back to normal. If such a thing exists, good. Thursday, it's good. And then Friday, God says, and he saw, very good. Says the Medrash, you know what very good refers to? You know what he saw? He saw the Satan. Toiv, Yetzer Toiv. Toiv Mo'oid, Yetzer Hara. That has to be understood. See, they wake up the student, our sages, when they put in these good is good. The Yetzer Toiv is good. Okay, I get that. Very good, Yetzer Hara. Go make sense of that. So let's go. I mean, the snake, the Yetzer Hara, Very good. Zula Toiva. What is that? What does that mean? So first of all, if we can just use, if when we speak about a demonic force or a real bad, something that's bad, without whitewashing it, so I'm just using as an example fear, okay? I know that there's a certain type of fear that's healthy and good. I'm not talking about that fear, right? If something bad is coming towards you, right, your fear will probably make sure you stay out of trouble to the best of your ability. I'm not talking about that fear. I want to speak about the fears that most people are familiar with, that are overwhelming, fears that don't bring any benefit to you. At times you don't even know where it's coming from, but you have fear. Or, like any other emotion, there was an experiment that Pavlov did. People use the Pavlovian experiment, and that is that what he did was he wanted to show that when we associate something bad with something neutral enough, then the reaction towards the bad shifts to the neutral. The example he gave was is that when you bring food to a dog, that was the experiment, that dog was salivating, if that's the word in English. That means that you saw the saliva. It was such a good food. People hopefully try to cover their animal parts, so if their mouths begin to water, they keep it within and they downplay it. But the dog is emes, and the dog is salivating when he saw that, whatever, the food. And whenever the food was brought, he rang a bell. I don't know how many times he needed to do that. At some point, you ring the bell and the dog began to salivate. Because once the dog connected whatever that was with the bell, because it happened when the bell was ringing, so then, and that's many of us that certain things happen, we call them triggers now, right? Something, when this happened, something horrible happened. Or that person somehow did so much bad to you that it comes to a point that when you see the person before they did anything, you're already in fear. Why? Because they are already associated with something horrible. All right? The funny part or the tragic part of it, just as my example, is that it's just a matter of time with all of us, with all of the people that are around us. We are also the same perpetrators, whether we meant bad or not, is that I brought a lot of good to a lot of people, and I'm sure I brought a lot of anxiety to a lot of people, and a lot of not good to a lot of people. So what do you represent for them? So there are associations that you basically, you feel fear. In Brazil, the moil, the Balbavitcher moil, is the principal of the boys' school. And it's brilliant. Because when a boy goes into school, they don't remember, but they know that this guy should be respected. Like there's a certain link, I'm just kidding, but the concept, don't get nervous if you're having a boy, it's not that bad, oh my God, I said the wrong thing. Because we are all filled with unhealthy fears, and I'm just using that as an example. So some people, their Yetzer Hara in root will be fear. Speak about fear. And the fear can become so paralyzing, so horrible, right? When people get panic attacks, they think they're dying. Overwhelming fear, panic, is that they begin to develop fear from fear. Okay. And where do people go from there without real help? What they go from there is that they begin to avoid anything. They are so afraid of that experience, is that anything that might bring about that fear or something that, for me to be well, even though the fear is in me, the problem is in me. So ultimately, all of these techniques, they don't work. So my bad will be fear. Fear is the bad in my life. And it's very convenient for me to put the fear on a person who in the past did things from which I should be afraid of, because then I get to live in a delusion, in my ignorance. Oh, I'm not a fearful person. I'm good. You're the problem. All I need to do is stay away from you. So I separate myself from from someone who brings fear to me, or from a certain setting, or from a certain behavior, that when I did that, I freaked out, so I just won't do it. You have a person, let's say, who public speaking, just as in public speaking, for some people can make them panic. So imagine if someone spoke in public, just imagine that. I mean, it's almost funny. In the middle of your speech, you panic. It's not a fun experience. So what's the solution? Simple, just don't speak in public. All right. If that works, good for you. At some point, that fear, which is triggered by public speaking, that fear which is inside of you, will manifest, no doubt. So what should one do? What one should not do is think that there is a way of getting rid of the fear. You're not going to get rid of the fear. What one should do, well, is completely surrender to the fear, have a new relationship with the fear, new relationship of the fear, and learn something from it. That which is your Yetzer Hara actually has something to teach you. And that would be turning something negative into something positive, not by making it positive in the superficial world. Oh, now it's great. No. It will remain a negative. But we're going to have a different understanding of it. There's going to be at some point not only an acceptance of it, but it will actually be bringing us gold, or it will be transforming us into gold. And if one can apply this to whatever their Yetzer Hara is, and it's important to get to a deeper Yetzer Hara, not to a external Yetzer Hara. It can be anger, right? It can be loneliness. It can be. I'm talking about the core. It boils down to just a handful of underlying, what one can call real, overwhelming, negative emotional experiences that we think that the goal is to overcome it and to get away from it. And on some level, that's okay. But then you only have good. You don't have it very good. You will not have it very good. The very good is not by looking for the silver lining. Looking for the silver lining is not good enough. Because looking for the silver lining is that this is bad, but because of this bad, look at what good came from it. We're not going there. We're speaking about someone who is able to look at the bad, to see the bad, to understand the bad, but to have a new way of relating to it. Fear. I'm giving you my exact fear. So the fear of fear, there has to be a point. So fear is horrible. So then you develop fear of fear. And there has to be a complete acknowledgement or surrender to the fact that I have fear from fear. I have fear from fear. And I'm not going to deal with it by making a way, by ignoring the fear. No.
Okay, so now that you have the fear and you try to rebrand the fear and sit with it, what does the fear teach you? What is it that the fear is trying? What are you supposed to get from
it? I think it's very personal. And I think the question has to remain open-ended. I think fear is something more universal. I think the basic negative Yetzer Haras.
So is it like an acceptance?
It's more than an acceptance, because an acceptance in itself won't give you the goal that it's here to give you. In other words, I understand that Moshe Rabbeinu was never accepting that he's not entering the land. He was teaching us something with that. And his not acceptance is not what most people will think of not acceptance. He was contending with it. He was asking God, like, why? what's the meaning of it? He was never satisfied. Because if he would have been satisfied, it would no longer have been something bad. It would have. It forever remained something that you can call it bad. It's a snake. It's the Yetzer Hara. Not fear. It was something that did not allow him to rest. Instead of understanding, no, the goal is just to have everything calm. And of course we want that. And of course we should have many moments of that. And halavai, even more moments of things are great. No one is looking for it when things are bad. But no one is coming with a delusion that things will never be bad. That's not redemption.
That's childish. You're going to be in a constant fight.
Is that we are all destined. We are all destined to have something of great significance, that without really facing it and having the right attitude towards it. It's having the right attitude towards it. It's a menace from which there is no escape because it's in me, and everyone is trying to escape. Because everyone is being told that you're meant to be great. Yeah. And if there's a non-great, well then take a pill or get drunk or distract yourself or dissociate or everyone does whatever they do. And all of these things do not work. They don't work. They work temporary, but they don't work. And whatever we don't face becomes stronger and bigger. And we have to just face it. Not with everything is good. There's such a misunderstanding of everything is good. No. Moshe Rabbeinu was not going into Israel on some level was not good. But that was the good of it. And him contending with it did not mean he didn't accept it. It's not like when you accept something, everything just becomes peaceful. Right? So your denial, whatever the steps are, right? then you get angry, right? And then you become depressed. Then you accept. I would say that certain things, yeah, they are accepted and they have to be contended with at the same time. And just one without the other is not wholesome and not healthy, and I don't think it's MS. So when we're speaking about the passing of a parent is something we accept because it's natural. A passing of a child, God forbid, is not natural. How does one accept that? The overwhelming pain changes. I don't think it goes away. And that, let's call pain, I think that's what the sages were saying, that the ultimate experience of life is not only appreciating even more the good, which we sometimes underappreciate. What's good is good. Celebrate the good. Be grateful for the good. So God saw that's good. But when we see that which is not good, that we have to have a new understanding of the not good. Not by making it into good. You know, it's the miracle that happened to this man was not that the earth became gold. It didn't become gold. But that the dirt had value. The dirt was valuable. The depression is valuable, mamish. And is the fear, and is the anger, and is the jealousy. In act, person feels that they don't belong, they don't fit. Whatever the underlying. And when people really face it, there's going to be a lot of pain, because most people just avoid it. They think of themselves too little. They think of themselves too fragile, all of us. This is the way we are voting ourselves into having low self-esteem. How can I face that? Oh, it's overwhelming. Well, if God gave it to me, it's very difficult, very. But I won't die from it. I will not.
How do you contend with it?
I think that this is personal. Maybe you need someone professional. But that concept, these concepts are very beautiful. Let's begin with that. It begins with a belief in yourself, a belief that you are able to contend with it. Another belief that not every bad has to be made into good. The dirt did not become gold. That's very meaningful.
Is the gold inner peace, like a stability within yourself while everything's happening?
You want to know what gold means?
I just want to know what we're supposed to be.
Supposed to be what you are right now. Let's begin with that. That's very important.
Okay, so
you're supposed to be what you're at right now.
Okay. And you address the fear, right? You see the fear, you sit with the fear.
If you have it.
Yeah, or whatever. I'm just as the example.
Correct.
Of fear.
And you know that it was given to you by God.
It's given to you by God.
It's not of your making. It's certainly not another human being's making.
And that's beautiful.
One second. And it's not something that you can control. There's many steps.
Right.
In other words, you have to surrender your control over it. Avoiding it won't work. It's a matter of time for everyone to come to that. Now, someone can buy into that when they're 40, or they can experience that when they're 70. These are your two choices, and then waste 30 years. It's one of the two. But when you have to confront it, there's a reckoning. Every person has a reckoning. And part of life is that reckoning. And when we understand that this is meant to be here, where I am at right now, the best I can do is that acknowledgement will make you into gold. I don't see how that is gold, but that will be the ultimate. But that being gold does not mean, like the alchemist, the superficial understanding of the alchemist, that we're just going to take however they did it, if they did it. They would take something that has no value and make it valuable. It's that we misunderstand that which we have in our lives. On the very superficial level, that there are so many good things that we have that we don't see its full value.
I think what I'm trying to say is that if at least you come to that acceptance, surrender, and you come to some sort of inner peace, then at least other people can see you having that. You become the gold.
Thank you. First of all, you will have a lot more serenity than not. I think that most people are using up a lot of their energy unconsciously, denying, avoiding the things that they'll have to face. Once you surrender to right now, to what is right now, God is in the present. And most of us hopefully have amazing moments that don't demand any type of readjusting the way we understand things. It's great. And most of us have many moments that are very difficult. So giving up control over that which we have no control over is for sure a prerequisite. Surrendering control to God is a prerequisite. Then God becomes real. Then whatever comes our way, it's not just words that someone with a yarmulke preaches, that we believe that God is the one who's doing everything. He's the mover, he's the shaker. No, we have to live that. Okay, so now everything is coming from God. Everything coming from God, the snake that he lifted up, if only you would see how this is really good. No. It's a snake. Snake is not good. For me, a snake is horrible. A venomous snake for sure is horrible. For me. Because the snake bit you, now you have antibodies. That's also truthful, but that's not what the ultimate. That's not the ultimate. The silver lining is denying the bad. And no, I would rather not have the bad to have the silver lining. I don't want the lining, and I don't want the bad. If I were to be given the choice, but I'm never given the choice. God is the one in control. And there's something that I need to contend with. Every person needs something to contend with, to struggle with.
Is it like knowing that we have a Yetzer Hara and that our life, we're going to be contending with it?
Let me go. Very good. Yeah. I'm just making the word Yetzer Hara. I'm using different words because many people limit the extent of the Yetzer Hara. They make the Yetzer Hara into something very little. So, you know, in the religious observance, in that area, I have my Yetzer Hara, I want to eat on Yom Kippur. It's much deeper than that. Wanting to eat on Yom Kippur is natural, human. It's a heart of something much darker that most of us don't have the courage to face. And my understanding of transformation is not that the bad becomes good. That's a misunderstanding.
Is
that I'm having a new relationship with the bad. Goes without saying, if you want to use the word Yetzer Hara, that never will acting out a Yetzer Hara be justified ever. We're not going there. We're not talking about anything related to human behavior. We're speaking about what's inside of me, because I have control with effort over my behavior. That's a foundation of Judaism. That's why God gave us commandments, because if God gave me something that I should be doing, that means that I have the power to do it. But when it comes to that which is deeper than behavior, we have very little power over. Very little power over. We have a certain input, can force feelings, feel the way you feel. You can try to manipulate feelings, and that's very dangerous, and you pay a price for that, and it doesn't work, and it backfires. It's like a denial. It's like, what is? And I want to add something that I really chapped, correct or not, but my understanding of why did they lift the snake up. I know many people here are very young, but some people here already have married kids, and it's a big blessing in life, and hopefully everyone will have married children and then grandchildren. Amen. And what's amazing is that we all make mistakes in life, and we begin to see the consequences and the limitations and the struggles that our children are having, and we can connect it to us. And I think that the least helpful thing is to tell a child, oh, don't do what I did. I know this one. What I do think is that if we see something that needs rectification in the child's life, that we can own, that we can really own and understand that we are the ones responsible for it, then the more work we do on ourselves at that given moment, on my deficiency, this is the greatest way I'll help them deal with their snake. And that's my understanding of the lifting of the snake up. So the responsibility that we have as parents is much less, especially when the kids are older. When the kids are younger, then there's a certain responsibility. The kids should not run across the street. It's our duty to keep our kids safe. If we think we can do that, we have to do our part for sure. But the older they get, the only way we keep our kids safe is by really taking in and seeing how all of these Yetzer Haras, they're really multi-generational. This we know now. It means all of our failings, if we want to have a cop-out, we can blame it on our parents. But then it will never end. It will never end. Then the kids will have the same issue, and then they'll blame it on us, and then their kids will have it. And the only way it stops is that when we own it. And many times we are able, when people get older, they mamish can see that a certain dynamic is replaying itself in the next generation. Literally, if you just look good enough. And that's an additional opportunity to face that which one should have faced 20 or 30 years ago, to face that now, to deal with it now. And that will be the best that we can do to free the next generation from the serpent that is working its way down from the beginning of time. Everyone, every generation has a responsibility to do the best they can do to stop it from continuing. So when we say that the serpent goes up, you know, people want freedoms without responsibilities. That's human nature. We want to be free without, you know, who gets to be free and has no risk? Who gets to do that? A baby. So when we see in ourselves that desire, I wish everything that I need will be met and I'll have all of the freedoms that I need, with no responsibilities, we're going back. We are regressing. And part of that regression is by blaming it on the parents, because my parents will always see me as a child, as we see our kids as children. And I'm sure it's very frustrating. In other words, if I will remember the frustration that I felt when my parents looked at me as a teenager, like I'm a child, we do that. But the way we keep on doing it, the way we buy into this fallacy, is by blaming it on them. But we should do it in the reverse way, of owning up, of understanding that the snake begins with us, and if we properly relate to whatever it is that we are relating with. So if I'm dealing with fear or anxiety, if I learn how to relate to it better, and I ultimately come to a place where it's not words, where I really accept that there's a lot of good in being anxious. This doesn't take away my responsibility to minimize my anxiety. If someone has a chemical imbalance, they should go to a psychiatrist and get that treated. This is not, we're not 100%. We're talking about some sort of inner relationship with that which is haunting us, with that which is oppressing us, with the horrible. When we do that, we do a lot. We do a lot for the future. And we turn our mud into gold. So that's that.